From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where the unemployment rate in pockets of the community is 9 times the national average, especially among people of color.
Today, we'll talk with Wisconsin State Senator Gwen Moore as the Democrats and Republicans prepare for their coronation ceremonies at their national conventions this summer. The Green Party comes to Milwaukee this week to pick a nominee.
Milwaukee will be the site of the Green Party's announcement of putting in for President of the United States and giving that tradition of democracy and the people a choice to vote for another president other than the Republicans or the Democrats.
We'll also look at the Bush administration's latest sanctions against Cuba, and we'll talk with Milwaukee's last socialist mayor, Frank Zeidler. He was twice reelected during the McCarthy era. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm Amy Goodman. The New York Times is reporting today that the detainees held in isolation at Guantanamo Bay have produced little useful intelligence, and that maybe no more than a dozen of the 600 detainees are sworn members of al-Qaeda. The Times concludes, quote, government and military officials have repeatedly exaggerated both the danger the detainees posed and the intelligence they've provided. The Supreme Court is expected to rule soon whether the U.S.-provided government can legally detain the men there definitely without ever pressing charges. While Guantanamo Bay is the most publicized U.S.-run detention center, the Washington-based group Human Rights First has issued a new report on how the U.S. is now running 24 secret detention centers around the world. The report concluded, quote, the U.S. government is holding prisoners in a secret system of offshore prisons beyond the reach of adequate supervision and accountability of law. Some of the detention centers are believed to be located in Pakistan along the Afghan border on the Indian Ocean island of Diego Garcia and in Jordan. On Friday in Saudi Arabia, a group connected to al-Qaeda beheaded Paul Johnson, the U.S. contractor working for Lockheed Martin. The group that carried out the attack is now claiming sympathizers in the Saudi security forces helped facilitate Johnson's kidnapping by setting up a fake checkpoint to stop him and abduct him. Saudi officials are denying the report. Soon after Johnson was beheaded, Saudi officials said they killed 4 men connected to al-Qaeda, including alleged ringleader Abdulaziz al-Mukrin. It is unclear how the Saudis were able to track him down so quickly after days of being unable to find him. Initial reports said Saudis had found Johnson's body, which led them to al-Mukrin, but now the Saudis are saying they're still searching for Johnson's body. Meanwhile, in Iraq, a South Korean man has been taken hostage by members of the Iraqi resistance who are threatening to kill him if Korean troops do not leave Iraq. The Guardian of London is reporting British military police are investigating claims that British soldiers mutilated the bodies of 7 members of the Iraqi resistance after a firefight last month. One of the Iraqis reported had his eye gouged out of his eye socket. Doctors found the eyeball in the dead man's pocket. The National Lawyers Guild has called for President Bush to be prosecuted for war crimes for approving or failing to stop the torture of detainees. The Guild also charged the Bush administration had illegally tried to justify the use of torture by claiming the president has the right to disregard existing laws. In related news, more than 400 legal scholars last week signed a letter to Congress urging them to consider impeaching President Bush. Meanwhile, a U.S. military judge has ordered the Abu Ghraib prison not to be torn down because it is a crime scene. Investigative reporter Seymour Hersh has revealed in the pages of The New Yorker that hundreds of Israeli agents, including members of Mossad, are now operating in Kurdish areas of northern Iraq. In addition, Mossad is now conducting covert operations in Kurdish areas of Iran and Syria. One former Israeli intelligence officer told Hersh, quote, "It's realpolitik. By aligning with the Kurds, Israel gives eyes and ears in Iran, Iraq, and Syria." In other news from northern Iraq, the New York Times is reporting mass numbers of Kurds are ignoring U.S. orders and reclaiming land in the area that had been seized by Iraqi Arabs during Saddam Hussein's reign. The appointed prime minister of Iraq, Iyad Alawi, announced on Sunday the new unelected government may soon impose martial law and ban all public demonstrations. Other Iraqi officials said the government may set up more checkpoints, issue curfews, and change the existing law to make it easier for police to search homes. In addition, Alawi defended the U.S. military attack in Fallujah that killed 22 people. The U.S. said it was attempting to kill Abu Musab Zarqawi, the Jordanian man who has been blamed for leading the Iraqi resistance. The U.S. claimed it hit a safe house and that close associates of Zarqawi died, but a member of the U.S.-backed Fallujah Brigade told USA Today the house contained ordinary families with women, children, and elders. A new study by the Defense Manpower Data Center has found the military discharged 770 people last year because they were gay under the Pentagon's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. The majority of the discharge were enlisted personnel. This comes at a time that the military is issuing stop orders to prevent thousands of soldiers from retiring or returning home from Iraq. Hundreds of the discharged were specialists, including 88 linguists, seven of whom spoke Arabic. 39 specialists who worked on nuclear, chemical, and biological warfare were dismissed, as were 90 nuclear power engineers. The Observer of London is reporting that Vice President Dick Cheney could be indicted in a $180 million bribery investigation in Nigeria involving Halliburton, the company that was headed by Dick Cheney before he became vice president. On Friday, Roman Catholic bishops in the United States agreed on a statement that concludes any Catholic politician who supports abortion rights is, quote, cooperating in evil. Some bishops are urging churches deny giving communion to Catholic politicians, such as Senator John Kerry, who support a woman's right to choose. In campaign news, John Kerry has called for the minimum wage to be increased from $5.15 an hour to $7 an hour by the year 2007. And sources close to the grand jury probing the collapse of Enron report the company's founder, Ken Lay, could be indicted on charges by the end of the month. Ken Lay is a close friend of President Bush, one of his top campaign backers during the 2000 election.
I'm Norman Stockwell from WORT Community Radio in Madison, Wisconsin, and this is Democracy Now!
My name's Tony Zerngevo from WYRU, Community Access Television in Madison, Wisconsin, and this is Democracy Now!
This is Anne Marie Cusick with The Progressive Magazine, and this is Democracy Now!
The This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, we continue our exception to the ruler's book and media tour through Wisconsin, major battleground state in the upcoming presidential election. This weekend, we were in Madison, Wisconsin, celebrating community radio station WORT and community television WYOU. We're also in Stevens Point, where we went to the Midwest Renewable Energy Conference yesterday. We arrived here in Milwaukee, where we broadcast on MATA, Channel 14 Community Television and West Allis Community Television. Wisconsin is a state which has two competing traditions. It is the home state of Senator Joe McCarthy, who led the witch hunts of the 1950s. It's also the home of the famous progressive leader Fighting Bob La Follette, who waged perhaps the most successful progressive presidential campaign in history. In 1924, he won almost 5 million votes as he pledged to, quote, break the combined power of the private monopoly system over the political and economic life of the American people. This city that we're broadcasting from today also has a very rich tradition. Milwaukee had 12 socialist mayors. The last of them, Frank Zeidler, will join us later in the program. He was mayor from 1948 to 1960, was reelected twice during the McCarthy era. He was also the Socialist Party candidate for president in 1976. Milwaukee also is a significant city in the struggle for workers' rights in the country. In the late 1800s, the Federation of Organized Trades and Labor Unions organized a movement to win an 8-hour workday. The campaign would climax on May 1, 1886. After that day, all workers not yet on the 8-hour system were to cease work in a nationwide strike until their employers met the demand. There were over 1,600 mass demonstrations across the country. And on May 3, 1886, a demonstration at Chicago Haymarket Square turned bloody when police shot four workers to death. The next day, a bomb was hurled into police ranks, killing several officers, wounding many more in what became known as the Haymarket Massacre. The next day in Milwaukee, striking steelworkers marching toward a mill in the Bayview section of the city were intercepted by a squad of militia who fired point blank into the strikers, killing seven. In 1968, Milwaukee was the site of the second major raid on a draft board during the Vietnam War. Following the Catonsville Nine action of May of 1968, led by Dan and Phil Berrigan, the Milwaukee 14 led a similar raid on a draft board in September of 68. This is also the home of Father James Gropey, who led many of Milwaukee's civil rights marches and fought for the rights of working people in the city. But despite the rich progressive tradition in the city, Milwaukee is held up by the Bush administration as an example, particularly in the areas of school choice and so-called welfare reform. President Bush came here to Milwaukee to launch his faith-based initiatives program. Many of the policies of former Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson have been used as a national model. Thompson, of course, is now Bush's Health and Human Services Secretary. Milwaukee is also one of the most racially segregated cities in the country. And according to our first guest, it is a city where the gap in socioeconomic status between white and black citizens is among the highest in the nation. We are joined now by Wisconsin State Senator Gwen Moore. She is currently running for the U.S. Congress. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
And we welcome you to the Milwaukee media market.
It's very good to be with you. Can you describe this state for us, and especially Milwaukee, in terms of various breakdowns of the population?
Thank you so much for asking this. First of all, Milwaukee is the only city of the first class in the entire state. That is a city with more than 500,000 people as residents. It's also a place where we have the youngest African-American population per capita in the United States. So there's a tremendous unemployment and underemployment that is tied to the youth of our city. And lacking in educational opportunity. here in the state. We have a bifurcated educational system. We've experimented with the school voucher program, and literally, because of our divestment in education, it has literally created a heartbreaking warfare between the public school system and private schooling in Milwaukee. Add that to the loss of manufacturing jobs, the crisis of providing health care, and it's a recipe for disaster. We have huge gaps in well-being between our minority community and our majority community. But even those folk in the majority community are suffering and hit hard by the Rust Belt economy of our state. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about these policies that have emanated from Wisconsin but have become national with the ascendancy of Tommy Thompson, who is the governor here and one of the top officials in the Bush administration, that have to do with welfare to work, that have to do with school choice?
Well, thank you for asking that as well. These policies were put into place as part of the presidential politics of 1996, welfare reform in particular.
Which was under President Clinton.
Under President Clinton, those welfare policies meant that we ended welfare as we know it without having done the work that we need to build a stronger economy. We had absolutely no plan in this state, in particular in Milwaukee, for creating jobs or providing the employment training. As a matter of fact, the day we started welfare reform, 10,000 women in this city alone were kicked out of technical college in order to fulfill the welfare to work requirements. 14,000 women statewide were kicked out of school. We had teenage moms, 14, 15, 16 years old, that were kicked out of school in order to go to work. It was a very ill-thought-out plan. We have one of the most onerous welfare programs in the country that doesn't allow education and training, that provides no lucrative job, and many women find themselves in a great lurch under this program. It's Frankenstein's laboratory for welfare reform. It's been described by New York paper Village Voices, Frankenstein's laboratory for welfare reform. School choice, once again, it sounded like a really great idea, but because of the divestment in education, the state backed away from two-thirds funding of schools. We took $450 million out of education, and we literally have 80% of the kids in the Milwaukee public school system eligible for free or reduced lunch. But we are only concerning, we find ourselves in a veritable war between the voucher schools and public schools over resources. While, of course, we're spending $200 billion on a war in Iraq, there are very, very many onerous implications for our state that need a national solution.
This is the home of the Bradley Foundation, which has been pushing forward on the voucher program. What kind of effect does that have on the political landscape here? A tremendous amount of money being poured in as a kind of laboratory for the country.
Exactly. And what is really wrong with the system is that there is now an effort to call for lifting any sort of requirements on the program, that the program participants meet income guidelines, that they are residents of Milwaukee. Literally, they're calling for a program that would allow wealthier folk from suburban areas of the county and of the state to be able to subtract aid from the poorest students in the state that live in Milwaukee. This is Brown versus supportive education turned on its head.
Hmm. We're talking to State Senator Gwen Moore. How does the war abroad affect Wisconsin?
Again, we've spent $200 billion. It was someone calculated that that's 100 $100,000 a minute that we're spending on the war. And in the meantime, we've had a $3 billion deficit in this state. And all of our energy is being spent. We've diverted, you know, millions, billions of dollars from education, healthcare, job development for the war. I think that there's not a lot of support for the war in this state. I've had to look into the faces of mothers whose children have returned in body bags. And it is a heartbreak emotionally, psychologically, and it hits us in our pocketbook as well. This is an unjust war that hurts both spiritually, economically, and emotionally.
Do you find that in this time, with the very cash-strapped states like Wisconsin, that in any way lines are breaking down between Democrats and Republicans? Because in a sense, you're in this together here with money siphoned off abroad. Do you find there's any kind of changing political landscape? For example, those who are with the president's party, Republicans who are opposed to the war, or Democrats who've supported the war, beginning to oppose it?
No, I think this state is polarized. 50-50 or 47-47, just like every other state, around the candidacies of the Democrats and the Republicans. What I'm more concerned with are those 10% of the people who are not necessarily undecided voters, but they're undecided as to whether or not to vote. Many of those people are people of color, they're women, people who are just fed up, people who find themselves in a maze economically, socially, they're marginalized. Those are the people, I think, that we have to appeal to. I think Republicans are Republicans and Democrats are Democrats. And there are the disaffected groups of people who are going to determine the outcome of the election here in this state.
Thank you.
You're all choked up, no doubt.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we continue with the War and Peace Report, sorry for the little frog in my throat. As John Kerry continues his search for a running mate, and rumors swirl about whether George Bush will keep Dick Cheney on the ticket, the Democrats and Republicans prepare for the official coronation ceremonies this summer at their respective national conventions. The only drama expected at the conventions will be the mass protests planned for the streets of Boston and New York. But there's one political convention that promises to bring heated debate and discussion, and it will all take place later this week here in Milwaukee, when the Green Party holds its national convention. In the 2000 election, Ralph Nader ran as the party's official candidate. This time around, Nader has said he'll be running as an independent with no party affiliation. Well, that doesn't mean he isn't seeking endorsements. In fact, he's already picked up the official endorsement of the Reform Party of Ross Perot. This week in Milwaukee, Ralph Nader will be asking the same from the Greens. But that's by no means a fait accompli. Nader is being challenged by Texas lawyer David Cobb for the party's endorsement. In fact, Cobb is seeking to run as the official nominee of the Greens. We're joined now by two members of the Green Party here in Milwaukee. Robert Miranda is editor-in-chief of the Milwaukee Spanish Journal, a bilingual weekly newspaper. He recently ran for city council here in Milwaukee. We're also joined by George Martin, who's program director of Peace Action. He's also co-chair of the Wisconsin Green Party, as well as co-chair of the National Party's Black Caucus, also a member of the National Steering Committee of United for Peace and Justice. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Sorry for my voice.
No problem.
Let's begin with you, George Martin. What do you expect at this National Green Party convention?
I really expect a true political convention. You know, as taxpayers in this country, we are footing the bill, I think, of $12.5 million for each of the Republican and Democratic conventions, which are just gatherings to pat each other on the back because determinations are already made. Here in Milwaukee, it's going to be entirely different. As you mentioned, the politics in terms of Ralph Nader, and also the politics of many in our party in terms of wanting a homegrown Green as our nominee, you know, someone who can truly articulate and has worked for our issues, and that the campaign be our campaign, our issues, and that we continue to grow.
Robert Miranda.
Well, the Green Party of the United States, and welcome to Milwaukee, Ms.
It's
Goodman.
It's great to be here. Is
out there trying to put its message into the political arena that the voters of the United States, really, they have choices. And the choices being, we're saying, is the Green Party. We see the party as the party that has courageous leadership, as a party that expresses and espouses the democratic ideals and principles that the two parties have basically, in the last decade or two, given up on. We are a party that is ready to challenge the private interest, the special interest that has polluted the process in the United States political system by allowing big dollars, big money to come in and dictate the policies of our government that benefit not the people of the United States, but benefit big business, benefit multinational corporations, benefit the very few and powerful in this country. And the time has come for a political party to come up and step up to the plate and bat for the people of the United States, and the Green Party is that party that is willing and wanting to do that.
Absolutely.
Well, what about the standard argument, the argument that you can stand for all these principles, you will be taking support away from the Democratic presidential candidate?
I am so glad that you asked that. You know, number one, there was no spoiler effect in the election of 2000. The Democratic Party analysis of that election speaks to that. It speaks to their campaign weaknesses, especially in the mid-states. And I, without a doubt, say also look to the National Rifle Association in terms of their impact against the party at that time. And thirdly, I say that the Green Party, half of our votes in 2000 came from people who had not voted before. And then lastly, less than half of this country votes. So the significance of third parties and what we need to do really does not have an impact at that level. In the future, we will be there at that level. But we need the opportunities, and we need change in electoral reform. We need instant runoff voting, which has proved successful in more than 40 countries in the world, a lot of communities in our own country.
Explain what that is.
Instant runoff voting, it's referred to as IRV, means that, for example, in the 2000 election, if I liked Nader but was worried about Gore not getting in, I could place Nader as my first preference and Gore as my second. If Nader did not get a majority, then my vote would go to Gore. And that is a very effective way to have national elections. Secondly, we have to look at campaign finance reform, not just on a token basis. As this Congress, both parties, voted for preemptive attack, they also tacked on a bill to say that consumers could not sue pharmaceutical companies. We have to really look at the system. That's why our party is not for sale. That's why we take no corporate dollars. And we don't take more than $3,000 from an individual. That's difficult in this era of massive dollars for campaigning. But the principles and the ethics in this country have to change.
Robert Miranda, what do you make of one of the, I believe it's David Cobb's view of not running in the swing states?
In my opinion, I don't agree with that. In my opinion, that this is the Green Party. The Green Party needs to grow, and it needs to step on anybody's toe. The Green Party is a party that espouses the ideals of democracy. It's a party that is there to protect the people. And both of these parties, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, specifically with people of color in this country, have failed us. They have abandoned us. All through the 80s, during the Reagan era, during here in Wisconsin, the Tommy Thompson era, the Democratic Party did not step up to challenge and articulate the arguments against the kind of tax-cutting schemes that the Reagan era promoted, the kind of tax-cutting schemes that even the Bush administration before Clinton, and even they didn't even challenge their own administration, Clinton, for allowing some of the policies and laws in the federal government, especially in the areas of higher education, to pass. They didn't push for the protections and welfare rights for women. And Clinton adopted the Tommy Thompson policies of welfare reform for the United States. And we know that in Wisconsin, that this welfare reform that Tommy Thompson implemented in Wisconsin is detrimental specifically to black women and to women of color here in Wisconsin. So as far as I'm concerned, the idea that the Green Party should not affect anything to do with the Democratic Party, I disagree with. I think that the Green Party needs to move forward, grow, and be the party of the people, for the people, by the people.
The two of you gentlemen have military in your blood. Your father, George Martin, soldier, a veteran. Robert Miranda, you yourself. Can you talk about this in relation to what we're seeing today?
Sure.
Talk about your history.
Well, I grew up in the south side of Chicago. Actually, I grew up in the neighborhood founded by the Young Lords, or where the Young Lords were founded. In 1980, I went to the United States Marine Corps, became a Marine, and from 1981 till 1989, I was a sergeant in the Marines. An epiphany happened to me while I was in the Marines. I was questioning the campaigns I was involved in. In the early 80s, you had Grenada, you had Lebanon. Then we started doing things in Central America. And I'm thinking to myself, how is this affecting our national security? What's going on here?
Were you involved with Grenada?
I was involved in Grenada. I was in the 2nd Marine Division out of Camp Lejeune. Our unit was there right before the October bombings in 1983 of the Marine Barracks in Lebanon. Actually, the unit that I was involved in was going to replace that unit. started occurring to me was there's something going on here. Finally, there was this captain, and you know, I have to say that this captain was enlightened. He says, when I asked him, you know, what are we really engaged here? What's going on here? He turned me on to this book, and it was a book written by a very famous Marine general, Major General Schmedley D. Darlington Butler. The book was called War is a Racket. And he gave me this book, and it was paperback, all torn up. And he says, why don't you read this book while we're on our way to the Middle East? And so, you know, we had plenty of time. So I'm reading the book. And, you know, and as I'm reading this book, this is a Marine general who is celebrated in the Marine Corps as the most highly decorated general in the armed forces, in the history of the armed forces, and with two Medal of Honors. This individual wrote this book upon his retirement, gave a speech in Congress where, you know, what really struck me was that when he talked about his career, he said he could have taught Al Capone a thing or two about how to run Chicago, where Al Capone may have run three districts in Chicago. He was operating out of three continents. And I was thinking to myself, whoa, this is the guy who the Marines are telling me to idolize. But yet, in this book, he's telling me that what he was engaged in during the early 1900s, the 1920s, in Latin America, Nicaragua, in other parts, he felt they were wrong, and it was not in the best interest of the people of the United States, but more in the best interest of the people who were operating out of Wall Street. And so when I was looking at this, I figured out, holy cow, you know what? We're not here for democracy. We're here for the plutocracy. We're here for the people who are controlling Wall Street, our economy. And in this issue of the Forbes magazine, you'll see Steve Forbes in his little spiel there for his news magazine. He's even arguing that the war on terrorism should be tied into the economy. And I'm thinking to myself, we're building an economy that should benefit off the misery of other people around the world. And this is exactly what General Butler was talking against. And that's what committed me to the Greens. That's why I went to the Greens, because the Greens understand this very, very intuitively. And for people of color in this country, especially the Latino community, the Black community, we need to start analyzing and realizing that what we're being used for is fodder for the people in Wall Street who really don't care about us.
George Martin, you're the son of a soldier. You're also one of the leaders of Peace Action, which is also having its national convention here in Milwaukee. Your thoughts now on the war?
I'll tell you, I have so many thoughts on the war. As I was raised within our family, you know, the ills of militarism, the racism with militarism, I understood very young. I was drafted out of Marquette University and went to my draft board, along with a friend who was drafted, and we shouldn't have been. And right next to us, they said, you're going, to me, and they said to him, it's okay, you can stay in school. And now we're looking at that kind of racism in terms of any draft, and with the upcoming draft, and young people should really be aware of it, and it's a whole other topic. You know, on the other end, I have served homeless veterans in Milwaukee and in the state and nationally for 18 years, and I continue to do so. We have homeless vets who have served in Iraq already living on the streets of Milwaukee. You know, the whole concept of what's happening, we know the ills to the Iraqi people. I was there in January, and I talked to hundreds and hundreds of people and listened. I was there on behalf of United for Peace and Justice.
In Iraq.
In Iraq, in the Occupation Watch. And I'll tell you, when the opportunity was there to talk to our troops and understanding the psychology of it, the psychology of being on military alert for a year and the stress, and then being the attackers and doing horrible things in the process, and now being the police under occupation and being the targets. You know, suicides were up 69% all in Iraq last year. Nurses report that they're at 20 to 30% rates in terms of self-inflicted wounds that they treat. More of the truth is coming out. And every one of our men and women that I talked to there said, when we were in private, said the same thing that we saw on the day that Baghdad fell on TV. They said, I want to come home. You know, and out of United for Peace and Justice, we say, end the occupation and bring our troops home.
Do you think it matters whether it's George Bush or John Kerry sitting in the White House?
I'll tell you, not only to those involved in our organizations, but I hear it constantly from other people who are questioning, you know, what Kerry would do. You know, I'll tell you, we work on a nonpartisan basis in some organizations, and some we're very political. But we've got the push on to both him and signed on by hundreds of organizations, along with Danny Glover, Howard Zinn, Susan Sarandon, and many other people, and part nonpartisanly also to say to Bush to end this occupation, take a stronger stance in terms of ending this war and bringing our folks home.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us. George Barton, who sits on the National Steering Committee for United for Peace and Justice. Robert Miranda, editor-in-chief of the Milwaukee Spanish Journal, a bilingual weekly newspaper, recently ran for city council in Milwaukee, both with the Green Party, which is having its national convention this week in Milwaukee. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be joined by the last socialist mayor of Milwaukee. We'll also be talking about Bush's policies towards Cuba. Stay with us.
¿Dónde están los de la nueva generación? Son y mira, ponte en el fuego de la acción. Con presión de la lírica, mística, psíquica. La rumba ha comenzado con Anga, Franco Pro, el negro Yoruba, hijo de Guá, Candela. Escucha cómo suena, no hay más nada. Sonido fuerte, ardiente y pegajoso. Sinceroso, te destrozo. Mi flow que calma sin fatiga a los nerviosos. Con mi conexión, controlando bien mi lengua. Pegado hasta el techo, quiero que lo entiendas.
Botella ron, tabaco abajo. Chicas por doquier, poncha casa.
Seguir. Yo represento Romulata, Cuba hasta el fin. Mi oricha como un imperio voy a construir. Yo hoy te dejo mi tema como mi emblema se finí.
No, no te vayas.
Dirigiendo dicha el mundo pa' la valla. De oriente hasta occidente gritamos a la batalla. Mi gente en talla y toma el jack que te desmaya. Ay, ay, y te me callas.
Ya te lo digo el guerrero.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman, and this is the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. June 30th has been designated by the Bush administration as the date of the official handover of sovereignty in Iraq. But it's also a key date in the Bush administration's newest adjustments to the blockade against Cuba. On Wednesday, the U.S. government published the regulations in the Federal Register. The latest sanctions against Cuba have been under discussion for several weeks, but the official announcement comes after the formal recommendation from George Bush's interagency commission tasked with proposing steps to bring down the government of Fidel Castro. The new rules permit Cuban Americans to visit immediately relatives on the island only once every 3 years instead of once per year. Visits can last no longer than 14 days. U.S. citizens who are not Cuban Americans are banned from visiting the island nation. The regulations ban travelers from bringing back any Cuban merchandise and receiving any gifts of goods or services from Cuban nationals, the Cuban government, or citizens of third countries. And authorized visitors will only be able to take $300 in cash to Cuba, down from $3,000. Educational visits to Cuba will also be curtailed. In response to the new moves, Florida Republican Congressmember Lincoln Diaz-Balart said Bush, quote, is the best friend the cause of freedom for Cuba has ever had in the White House. Congressmember Ross Leighton, also Republican from Florida, said the measures, quote, will rob the dictatorship of funds to further oppress the Cuban people. We're joined now by Art Heitzer, a Milwaukee-based attorney. He's currently the chair of the National Lawyers Guild Cuba Subcommittee and works with the Center for Constitutional Rights, representing people who break the U.S. travel ban on Cuba, which I believe is about to happen again. Art Heitzer, we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy, and good health, too.
Thank you. Thanks, I need it. Well, just can you briefly talk about the significance of June 30th and the Bush administration's policy toward Cuba?
Sure. Well, since it's took power, the Bush administration has targeted Cuba for regime change and particularly put U.S. citizen civil liberties on the chopping block. And what's happening on June 30th, it's very interesting because now they've reached to the point of targeting large elements of the Cuban-American community because they apparently are taking the advice of extreme right-wing elements within that community. And those who have recently arrived and who consider the sanctity of the Cuban family more important than trying to get rid of Castro are now being targeted. So you see, for example, that Cuban Americans who want to go back and visit their relatives are told that they cannot do so more than once every 3 years, and they can only visit their immediate family. So if you have an aunt or a niece or a cousin or something like that, you can't go at all. And if your mother is there and she's very sick and you visit her, and then you find out 2 years later that she's dying, they say, tough luck. You made your choice. You have to wait another year until she's been dead for a year. And this is causing massive unrest within the Cuban-American community, even in Florida, which is very interesting because I think it's a political miscalculation. But academic visits are extremely restricted so that now only full semester courses are allowed. Typical course where a seminar would go for a couple weeks, those are not going to be allowed anymore. And the category fully hosted, which is very interesting, has now been abolished, which means the whole rationale of saying that we're not trying to prevent the right of travel, we're just trying to prevent money from going to prop up the Castro regime, is now really going out the window. And they're saying that even if you're going to Cuba, you're not going to spend any money because you're a host of someone else. That they're not going to allow that except when you apply in advance and they decide whether or not you can go. So this is all in the context. You mentioned Congressman Diaz-Balart. He called for the assassination of Fidel Castro just in the last few months. So it has to be seen in the context of the extremely aggressive Bush policy from Iraq to other countries and targeted on Cuba, and to prevent any kind of normal exchange between the average person of the United States and the average person of Cuba.
Mm-hmm. That's travel. What about other issues related to Cuba? And you talk about Florida, which is an absolutely key state. What this is doing in Florida among Cuban exiles?
Well, besides travel, which I think is key because I think probably on both sides, the sentiment is that if the average American was able to go to Cuba and see that the rest of the embargo policies probably could not survive. So I think that's very key. But there's control of exchange, even for a U.S. publication to print a Cuban article that they edited or translated. They've been warned not to do that, and they might face criminal sanctions. There's been, Jesse Jackson has talked about the potential, and others, the potential that Cuba is on the list of U.S. targets for even military action. You have this commission that was appointed that has come back and talking about really regime change in Cuba and that's their goal to change the Cuban government. And within the Cuban-American community, I mean, we're actually people on our side of the fence who want to change the policy are talking about voter registration within the Cuban-American community because those who've come in recent years are really much different than those who left in 1959 or 1960 who were in very powerful positions. That element, which is still politically powerful by and large, seems to want to harm the Cuban people in order to overthrow the revolution, and they don't care what happens to the average Cuban, whereas many others feel much differently.
We only have a minute more to go. Is there a difference between Bush and Kerry on Cuba?
In fact, I think there is. While both express hostility towards the revolution, Kerry's position is in favor of allowing much broader form of travel, and if there is travel allowed broadly, I think that our policy cannot be sustained because the average American coming back will see that the policy makes no sense. And so the extreme hostility the provocation, the potential of perhaps even military action, having U.S. military craft fly in and around Cuba in order to broadcast messages, etc., which could be a military provocation. I think Kerry is taking an initiative from Bush, which is really targeting even many Cuban Americans and saying, no, there should be broader travel. And that is a significant difference, and it could make a very big difference for the future. Mm-hmm.
Any other comment on what is most significant in looking out Cuba policy right now?
Well, I mean, it's the targeting of U.S. people. Not only have many forms of travel been made illegal that used to be legal in the last few years. Not only are there now administrative prosecutions of people in Washington, D.C. for the first time in 11 years this has now started, but you now have in Key West criminal indictments for the charge of organizing and promoting a sailboat race to Cuba. Not even spending any money in Cuba, but sending emails about scheduling, putting on a website that this regatta is going to happen, and people are facing 15 years in prison. This was just indictments came down in the last couple of weeks. So you see great threat against the American people. And there are responses. For example, there are three major travel challenges going on this summer. Pastors for Peace, you can get on their website, pastorsforpeace.org, for example, is one of the larger ones. They're leaving from Texas on July 8th. They're coming back, and the other travel challenges are coming back July 19th. These are very important for people to support. And hopefully this policy will be on the front page, and the average American doesn't understand why after 40-some years we can't go to Cuba. And the policy has no popular support. It doesn't have support in Congress. And this administration hopefully will be cut off on a short string.
Art Heitzer, Milwaukee-based attorney, currently the chair of the National Lawyers Guild Cuba subcommittee, working also with the Center for Constitutional Rights on Cuban issues. We turn finally on this trip to Wisconsin to the last socialist mayor of Milwaukee, Frank Zeidler. He was mayor here in Milwaukee from 1948 to 1960, last in a string of 12 socialist mayors reelected twice during the McCarthy era. Joe McCarthy himself from Wisconsin. In 1976, Frank Zeidler was the Socialist Party candidate for president of the United States. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Pleased to be here.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about politics here in Milwaukee and Wisconsin that's called a battleground state, and these two traditions? On the one hand, you've got McCarthy. On the other hand, you've got this, well, this history of socialist mayors. You've got fighting Bob La Follette.
Yeah, Milwaukee has gotten a very interesting history in that respect. Because it was an industrial town, and much of the industrial base here was based on immigrants from Germany and from Poland. And the persons from Germany, particularly the ones who came in 1848, were persons who had been engaged in the liberal revolution. For instance, the Milwaukee Turners is a historic society here that stems from persons who were engaged in the 1848 revolution of Germany, liberal revolution, which was an attempt to upset the German monarchy and German royalty and replace it with something like the American democracy or the French democracy. That was one base for it. Another base for the liberalism that Wisconsin has shown came from Norwegian immigrants. Of all the immigrants that came here, they were probably the poorest. And they became the base of the La Follette progressive movement in the late 19th century and the first part of the 20th century. However, as some of these people prospered, they became conservative. And so Milwaukee and Wisconsin has been divided between these two elements, the persons who have become conservative and the persons who still represent that liberal tradition of the persons of 1848 and the early Industrial Revolution. The question is, who won? Well, at the present time, the conservatives seem, with the exception of the governor, seem to be pretty much in control. But there's still a broad element in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin of people who want a progressive addressing of the problems that the United States faces. Mr. Heitzer here is one of them. He represents part of that tradition.
And what do you say about the state of the country today from this battleground state of Wisconsin as the last socialist mayor here?
Well, in my feeling of his history, and it goes back quite a bit, I don't see the country is as divided as it has ever been, perhaps almost since the Civil War. The division over the Bush administration and its foreign policies, particularly its idea of preemptive war and its hostility to other countries, say we're going to go it alone, its ignoring of the United Nations until recently, has caused a severe division in the country. And you go to different parts of the country, and they're either rabid Bush fans or they're very strongly opposed to him. He's a polarizing figure, and more than any other person that I can remember in my time, even than Franklin Roosevelt, who was something of a polarizing figure.
As a socialist candidate for president yourself in 1976, as a presidential candidate, do you have, do you feel that John Kerry represents a real alternative? And do you have a thought on this Green Party convention and a Green candidate against?
Well, anybody represents an alternative to the Republican policy. And Kerry, that he would not be as strong on issues as I would be on a lot of them, but he would be an improvement.
And the fact that the Green Party,
however,
is
the
here?
Socialist Party has its own candidate, one Walt Brown, of Portland, Oregon, and Walt's an interesting figure. He's been very active in campaigning in Oregon. He gets votes. He's an ex-naval officer, but he's in, something of a near pacifist at the present time.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being on with our national broadcast today, broadcasting on over 220 radio and television stations around the country and at democracynow.org. Frank Seidler, the last socialist mayor of Milwaukee, was mayor from 1948 to 1960. And that does it for today's program. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, as former President Clinton releases his memoirs tomorrow, we'll be playing an interview we did with him on Election Day 2000. Tell your friends to tune in. Democracy Now! Produced by Jeremy Scahill and Sharif Abdul-Quddus, Mike Burke, and Nogara Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton. Special thanks to Milwaukee Public Television and Mike Scahill, as well as Marco. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us from Milwaukee.